The oath that I have solemnly taken tonight means at its core that I will do my job without any fear or favor, and that I will do so independently of both the political branches and of my own preferences.
Last night, Amy Coney Barrett became the 9th United States Supreme Court Justice. In one of the most partisan displays of power we've witnessed in the past few decades, Republicans used their political majority to force Barrett's confirmation before Election Day. So far, 60 million votes have already been cast in the 2020 election, and Barrett's nomination process was one of the fastest ever for a Supreme Court nominee, lasting a little more than a month after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Barrett answered less than 20% of the questions posed to her during her hearing, leaving many Americans unclear about how the new justice might lean, and frustrating Democrats who remember how President Obama's SCOTUS nominee Merrick Garland wasn't even granted a hearing. For the current GOP, it was the culmination of nearly four decades of work on reshaping the court. Mitch McConnell starkly said this on Sunday.
A lot of what we've done over the last 4 years will be undone sooner or later by the next election. We won't be able to do much about this for a long time to come.
While Republicans bask in the glory of their third Supreme Court justice in less than 4 years, millions of Americans continue to face eviction, hunger, unemployment, and a third wave of coronavirus infections, and Congress remains deadlocked on a stimulus package. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and that's where we start today with the new Supreme Court and how it has changed for the foreseeable future. Joining me now is Christian Farias, a legal affairs journalist and regular contributor to GQ magazine, and Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS Blog. Thanks for being with me, both of you.
Great.
Hello,
to be on.
Thanks for having me.
Amy, let's start with you. The process of how now Justice Barrett made her way to the Supreme Court has been remarkable in how quick it has gone. How did this happen so quickly?
It was remarkably fast, but I think Republicans were determined to have her on the court as quickly as possible. You know, this Mitch McConnell, and you really saw once Judge Barrett, now Justice Barrett, submitted her questionnaire. They had been really considering her for a vacancy for a couple of years. And you saw when she submitted her questionnaire to the Senate Judiciary Committee that within a day or two after Justice Ginsburg's death on September 18th, they had contacted her about the possibility of filling the vacancy and had offered her the job on September 21st, I believe. They didn't announce it until September 26th, and then, you know, just moved forward at lightning speed.
There is an editorial, the editorial board of the New York Times wrote today about this process. And I have to say, Amy, it's one thing to have a remarkably fast confirmation process. And it's another thing, in the words that they use in this editorial, to use, quote, brute force here. I think that's what's frustrating to watch, is how a lot of this feels less about the American public and its citizenry and more about brute force and power on the part of the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, there was not a lot that the Democrats could do once the nomination had been made to stop her. And the Democrats, you know, sort of recognized that. And the strategy at the confirmation hearing was really less about any sort of procedural maneuverings to try to stop her. And they really focused on, you know, sort of their differences and what her confirmation would mean for the court, rather than trying to change the minds of any senators as such.
Christian, I want to bring you in here, because to Amy's point, there wasn't a lot that Democrats could do, but did they do enough? I feel like there was a lot of grandstanding. There were a lot of photographs left there. They protested by not showing up, but I don't know. I mean, could they have asked more questions? Judge Barrett, now Justice Barrett, only answered about less than 20% of the questions she was posed. So what could the Democrats have done differently here?
They actually did everything they could do, given the circumstances. As Amy pointed out, they're in the minority. Their options were limited. And really, they hammered home the point that they've been trying to hammer even since the last election, that the Affordable Care Act is on the line. And indeed, the law is on the Supreme Court's docket at the moment. And their point, I don't know if they were successful, they try to paint her as a surefire vote against the law, given her past statements. And the question is, will she go with that, yes or no? Was that a pre-election strategy to drive out people to the polls more so than defeating her? I think that's a question that the election is going to answer, because depending on how well this strategy worked and how big a turnout Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation result in, I think they'll then decide, do we have a mandate to do something else? I think it's less about stopping her confirmation, but more about whether voters have it in them to truly, exact and I almost fear this word, revenge for what happened, because millions, as the opening said, were already voting, 60 million as of yesterday. And in a sense, there's something quite anti-democratic about pushing through a nomination as votes are being cast, and as people may be already voting because Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, because they want a justice that is kind of in her mold. And the fact that Amy Coney Barrett is the exact opposite of that, that may itself result in political retribution.
And I want to pick up on that point, Amy, because the idea that this is anti-democratic that Christian just pointed out, I think, again, pointing back to this New York Times editorial, where essentially, it feels in many ways that the United States is somehow being held hostage by a minority view, quite frankly. And pointing out here that Republican presidents have appointed 14 of the previous 18 justices on the court. Americans have voted for Democratic nominees in 6 of the last 7 presidential elections. And yet this is what our Supreme Court looks like, Amy. How do we explain that?
I mean, I think that is what angers so many people. And, I think for the Republicans that it really is, as Christian said, you're talking about, there's the ongoing election, and it seems like Republican senators, at least, may well have made a calculation that they are going to take the, and I'm to be sure, I'm not a congressional reporter, but take the short-term pain that they may well lose their majority in the Senate for the long-term gain of controlling the Supreme Court for, possibly decades to come. You had Senator McConnell the other day talking about, how even if Democrats take the White House and, both houses of Congress, they'll have this Supreme Court that's able to sort of push back against the acts of Congress. I think that is what's frustrating Democrats so much, and is, part of the what's underlying the push, the calls for possibly expanding the court. The Vice President Biden has said that he wants to appoint a commission to sort of study the courts.
Just when I hear that we're thinking about appointing a commission, it just feels like that's another piece of Washington rigmarole and just, getting caught in the muck of Washington, when Americans are saying, you may want to appoint a commission, but this administration has just appointed 3 judges in less than 4 years.
Sure. I mean, I think, you have to look back that, I think people, that the idea that people are talking about court expansion sort of in the mainstream now, I think has come a long way. Like 2 years ago, even sort of whispering the word court packing was like completely taboo.
I want to get into court packing in a minute, because I want to talk about that strategically. But before we get to that, stand by, Amy. Christian, one of the things we hear over and over and over again is how judges should not legislate from the bench. And yet SCOTUS has, in many ways, because Congress is so broken, has had to become in many ways a legislative body. And pointing back to this New York Times editorial today, it says that today's conservative majority, and I'm quoting here, is among the most activist in the court's history. How do we explain the hypocrisy there, Christian?
It's interesting because the Republican agenda legislatively is so unpopular. The American public just doesn't want what Mitch McConnell and his party have to offer in terms of solutions for the American people, that the party turns to the courts to kind of enshrine their vision of society, their vision of how the world should work. So it's kind of this interesting interplay. You know, we don't have any bills to offer. We've already adjourned the Senate. McConnell last night adjourned the Senate until after the election without a COVID relief bill. You know, again, because his view of how that relief bill should look is not what people want. So rather than actually come to the table and offer solutions, he rather takes all his toys and go home. And the fact that he's now insisting instead on this new justice that will deliver outcomes for decades to come, a conservative majority, not just at the Supreme Court, but also in the federal appeals courts, which also decide many very important cases related to legislation and social policy. You know, it just shows kind of how they're planning to cement their vision for how Americans should live their lives. So,
but in the meantime, the problem is, as you mentioned, there are, you know, 8 million Americans have been pushed into poverty. And while the GOP has gotten its victory, it has kept its promise. President Trump in particular has kept his promise to make sure that they seat as many judges as they possibly can. They have done that, but they have abdicated their moral responsibility to the American public that is suffering right now. How do they expect to stand? And maybe this is to Amy's earlier point, that they're betting on the short term versus the long term.
Precisely. You know, and that's why it's interesting, because right now, based on this evident power grab, the question is, will voters respond? Will voters punish them? And we need to see what happens after the election, how big, if Biden wins, how big he wins, and also if he takes back the Senate, how big that take back is. Because based on that mandate, they will now have to make a decision. What do we do to reverse this trend? Yes, of course, they have this whole agenda. Biden, I'm sure, has all these things he wants to do. But the question is, will the courts too push back on those policy agendas? And if the courts begin striking down Democratic legislation, which is what many progressives and many Democrats fear, that Amy Coney Barrett and the conservative majority now, let's say there's a new Voting Rights Act that will protect the right to vote moving forward. Will an activist Supreme Court go and do away with that? Then what's even the point of passing Democratic legislation if you're going to have courts just striking it all down?
What is the concern about this word court packing?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure that there's that much of a concern right now. I think that Democrats are so upset about the way that things have played out, you know, the idea that the Gorsuch seat was a stolen seat, you know, that Mitch McConnell said we're not going to confirm a justice during the presidential election year, and then now that the Republicans are in the White House and they have the opportunity to confirm a justice during the presidential election year, and they went ahead and did it, but it was taboo for a long time. I think that there was a sense that you know, talking about court packing might somehow hurt the Democrats in the upcoming elections. And, you know, I'm not sure that there's a sense that there is much of a harm right now from talking about it. The idea
What about term limits, Amy? What about that? What about in implementing or limiting the power of the court? Is that something that Democrats could do?
It is something. It's interesting because term limits to many people, I was actually talking about this with my 17-year-old daughter this morning. Like, it sounds like a much more reasonable idea to many people. You know, the idea that, you know, 18 years or so sounds very, very civilized, you know, and then you would know when a justice was going to roll off in advance of an upcoming presidential election. You'd say, okay, this president would get to pick the next nominee. But that actually, my understanding is that it would be hard, and Christian can correct me if I'm wrong, would be harder to do because the Constitution gives Supreme Court justices life tenure, whereas the Constitution does not set the number of justices on the Supreme Court. So, you know, it seems somewhat counterintuitive that adding justices to the court might actually be easier as a constitutional and legal matter than limiting their terms.
Christian, in terms of the way that what we know about Judge Barrett, and I'm not going to get into how she will rule on A or B topic, because we don't know how she's going to rule and we can't predict that. The question I have is how little we took away from her after these confirmation hearings. She answered less than 20% of the questions that were posed to her. And I would love if you could help us understand that in the context of, for example, Sonia Sotomayor's confirmation hearing. How different were the two?
Yeah, she was not forthcoming at all. I mean, there were basic questions that she got asked, like, is voter intimidation illegal? And she wouldn't answer that, when the reality is it is illegal. What does she have to say about the peaceful transfer of power, or, you know, other authoritarian tendencies of the current president? And she wouldn't answer those things. And of course, the reality is that she was just protecting her own nomination, because we know that the president tends to, you know, not take kindly to people who cross him. And so she was shrewd in that sense. But the reality is that, you know, she took part in this process. She accepted it for all it is, for all its rush. She appeared on the balcony of the White House South Lawn last night for what looked like a campaign event, because Donald Trump tweeted a video of it.
And that's also not a typical or a behavior for a Supreme Court justice, is it?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that were atypical about this process. And the fact that, you know, she kind of took it all in and she played along. I mean, she was in the middle of that super spreader event when she was announced for COVID. I mean, it just tells you something, that she was pretty much in the tank with this whole thing. And I think people should draw their own conclusions from that. The reality is that she is on the court right now. There are cases before the court dealing with this very election, whether mail-in ballots will be counted, whether, everyone
would she
who
be
has voted,
would she be forced to recuse herself from those cases?
She won't be forced to do anything. Supreme Court justices call their own shots when it comes to recusal. And the question is, will Amy Coney Barrett do the right thing? And the reality is that there's already a majority in the court that is hostile to voting rights. The question here is, will she join them or will she step aside? Just last night, there was a huge number of opinions from the Supreme Court dealing with voting in Wisconsin. There's another case from Pennsylvania pending, another one from North Carolina. And this is where the rubber will meet the road. And what she does in those cases will be just a demonstration of whether she is independent or not. And I think if she recuses, at least she will be showing the public that, that the stakes are high and that her own integrity is on the line.
Amy, as we close out this segment, what does this do, the whole process, the way that this, the you mentioned Merrick Garland and Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, and now we've got Amy Coney Barrett. I mean, very contentious nomination processes, and yet, like as I mentioned, President Trump kept his promise to the American public by seating as many judges as he could. How has this changed the court for the foreseeable future? We've got about a minute and a half to go.
Yeah, so interestingly, until before the death of Justice Ginsburg, the Supreme Court sort of was doing actually fairly well in these polls involving public confidence. And so, you know, my impression has been that when you have something like this, the sort of perceptions of the Supreme Court do tend to take a hit. And then the Supreme Court, you know, usually will recover, but then it will take a hit again. But it will be, you know, the combination of this and the possibility that the Supreme Court could be drawn into election-related litigation, you know, I think it could certainly affect the public's perception. And you know, we saw this after Bush versus Gore. It may well take a while for the Supreme Court to recover.
Christian Farias is a legal affairs journalist and contributor to GQ magazine, and Amy Howe is the co-founder of SCOTUS blog. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're continuing our series, A Votar, where we talk about Latino voters ahead of the 2020 election and the issues that matter most to them. Today, we're doing something a little different, and we're turning to Latino candidates, specifically those who are running for Congress. This year, a number of Latino Democratic candidates are running for House seats that could make history. On the ballot are candidates who could become the first LGBTQ Latina in Congress, the first Afro-Latino, and the first Native American veteran. For more on these candidates and how they're resonating with Latino voters, we're joined by a friend of the show, Nicole Acevedo, a digital reporter for NBC News. Nicole, great to have you as always.
Of course. Thank you.
So who and how many people are we seeing Latinos running for Congress this year compared to previous years?
We had a really good year last time in the 2018 midterms when we have a record number of Latinos confirmed to the House. So essentially what we're seeing is them getting reelected and a bunch of other Latinos trying to grab seats from either candidates that people from Congress that decided to retire or are just challenging other seats.
What are some of the reasons why people are running? Because one of the things we've heard historically is that there aren't that many Latino leaders in particular. So why do people say that they're running this year?
Yeah, no. And I mean, even with the record number of seats in Congress last time around, that was still, you know, not proportionate to the amount of Latinos that live in this country, right? So from talking to candidates that could potentially make history in Congress this November, a lot of things that they had in common was that their races were very personal to them in the sense of growing up in with life experiences that maybe other members of Congress have not had, and then thinking that if they were in positions of power where they could make policy based on those lived experiences, not only on other experience they may have had in government or the nonprofit sector, maybe things could change for future generations. And let's remind ourselves that, you know, the Latino population is the largest minority group in the country. And we have 1 million Latinos turning 18 every year for the next decade or two. So we have a lot of Latinos coming of age, old enough to be able to be in positions of power and make policy, and also thinking about the ones that are coming behind them.
I want to talk a little bit about who these folks are. Let's start with Richie Torres. He's making some moves here in New York City, right?
Oh, yeah. And Richie Torres, if he is elected for Congress this November, he would become the first openly LGBTQ Latino in Congress. And the likelihood of him making history is very high because he is essentially be taking over this seat of Congressman Jose Serrano, who was a 16-term Democrat from the South Bronx. So given that it's a historically Democratic district, his chances of being elected are really, really high. And his upbringing in the South Bronx was like many, many people in that community, part of public housing, public schools, public hospitals. And his platform, his campaign platform is about, you know, hey, I grew up in these communities. I understand the need, and I'm going to advocate for those needs when I get to Congress.
Nicole, what about folks like Candace Valenzuela in Texas and Rudy Soto in Idaho?
So Candace Valenzuela, it's in a really interesting position because she's essentially in what we often refer to as a toss-up race, which means that it's 50-50. It could go 50-50 Republican, or it could go 50-50 Democrat. And she's a candidate looking to flip that seat for the Democrats. And the Democrats feel like they have a really good chance with her. And if she's elected, she will become the first Afro-Latina, the first Black Latina to be elected to Congress. So it's a big deal, not only because she would make history by being the first Afro-Latina, but because she could potentially help the House either keep their current power or gain more ground in that area.
What about on the Republican side, Nicole? Are there any emerging Latino voices there?
They are. We have, interestingly enough, in New Mexico, we have Teresa Leger Fernandez, who's a Democrat, but her opponent, Alexis Johnson, has told local media in New Mexico that she identifies as Hispanic and has Hispanic ancestry and Native American ancestry. So you basically essentially have two Latinas facing each other for the third congressional district in New Mexico. However, that seat has been historically Democrat. It was held by Ben Rey Luján, who is leaving the House now, and it's running for the Senate, and he's currently the assistant speaker. So even though we have a Republican there who are basically two Latinas facing each other, it's very likely that the Democrat, Teresa Leger Fernandez, will prevail. We also have a Latina Republican in New York. She, again, it's New York, which is predominantly Democrat. So her chances of her winning are slim. But if she does, she will be the first Republican Latina to win a seat in New York.
Does having more Latino candidates on the ballot signify that there might be more Latino turnout at the polls, or is that still too early to tell?
It's too early to tell, and not necessarily. Research historically shows that what really turns Latinos out to the polls is how you reach out to them. Especially in-person voter outreach is the most successful tactic in the middle of the pandemic that has become very challenging for campaigns and grassroots organizations mobilizing Latinos. But we've seen so far in early voting an increasing number of Latinos voting and young Latinos voting, many people for the first time. So I think it's an added thing that, oh, if they are Latino and they also stand for the things I believe in and they showed up to my door and things like that, the likelihood increases, but I don't think there's necessarily a correlation there that because there's more Latino candidates, we're seeing more Latino voter turnout.
We're also seeing a lot of this is just for the House of Representatives. Well, what about the Senate? I mean, that is one of the least diverse branches of our federal government. And I'm just wondering whether any Latinos have a chance of breaking into that upper chamber.
No, we had 4 Latinos in the Senate, if I'm not mistaken. As it comes to Latinas, the only one is still Catherine Cortez Masto, and she's the sole Latina running right now for Senate. We also have people like Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Mario Diaz-Balart, Bob Menendez that are familiar faces to the Senate, but we're not seeing enough new faces there like we are seeing in the House.
And do we know why that is? Is that usually a question of money, connections, or all of the above?
All of the above, really. And I also think in terms of the Senate, it's a little bit harder just the way their districts are sort of laid out. You have more chances in the House to sort of go more granular into who are communities and who are representing them.
Nicole Acevedo is a digital reporter for NBC News. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
As the weather cools down and the pandemic drags on, many of us are bracing for a tough winter. And even some of the hobbies that people took up to relax back in the spring might be starting to wear thin. Cooking, for example, is one of them. At the start of the pandemic, some people were fortunate enough to have the time and resources to try elaborate, time-consuming recipes. But 7 months in, that sourdough starter might be losing a bit of its magic. So to recapture some of that joy of cooking, we turn to an expert.
My name is Sola Awele. I am the video host of Stump Sola and a resident at Food 52.
Sola's new YouTube show is all about experimenting in the kitchen.
We need another plan. I don't think the floating mushroom islands are going to work. 18th century mac and cheese. It's not going to look anything like the mac and cheese from right now, but you know, it's the 18th century. Grand finale. Twinkie. I'm going to turn the Twinkie into an ice cream sandwich. I'm going to try and make like a liquid sablé cookie with the cake and then swirl the cream in some ice cream that we also got from Bodega.
But outside of her show, Sola's been trying to keep it a little simpler lately.
I, just like everyone else at the beginning of the pandemic, was really indulgent and baked a lot, made a lot of cakes, bread, pies, cookies. But now I think I need to like move into the healthier food route, meaning a lot of quinoa and beans.
Before we got into some of Sola's cooking tips for the coming months, she told me how cooking has helped her cope during the pandemic.
There's something just really comforting about making yourself a meal that really helps in this like chaos to just come home and like take some time. Well, I guess we're not going anywhere. Stay home and take some time to make a really nice dinner. Sit down with your family. Because I didn't really have that. My husband works crazy hours, so we rarely got to eat together. So it's really nice being able to have meals together. And it just like centers like our life a little bit.
What about how you cook? You talked a little bit about what you're cooking, but what about how you cook? Are there specific routines? Are there things that you do, you know, during this time? Like you said, we're not going out much. So are there any routines that you've tried to stick with?
Yeah, I've definitely gotten more into meal planning and trying to focus more on cooking stuff that's like one pot or one pan, because cooking three meals a day, it's just like an incredible amount of dishes, and it's quite a lot of work. So I've just been trying to be a bit more organized, like roast a bunch of squash to eat for a few days. Things like that have really helped make it a lot easier.
Is that part of what you would recommend for folks, especially as we head into these colder months? Because one of the things I learned the first time around was making sure your freezer is as stocked as it can be with frozen vegetables, and if you eat meat, with meat. And I kind of, you know, was doing it ad hoc, but this time I made a concerted effort to go out and get frozen vegetables and different cuts of meat that I could then, you know, separate and freeze.
Yeah, I mean, actually, we have a really small New York City refrigerator, which doesn't work very well. So we can't really depend on our freezer very well. Our freezer doesn't really freeze things. So we're more of like a stocking up on the pantry kind of people. But for me, it's like, I don't really like making my meals in advance because I get kind of bored, but I like prepping out parts of different components of dishes that I can like play around with later, like make a big pot of beans, cook up like a quart of quinoa, roast a bunch of vegetables, and then you can kind of mix and match during the week without getting bored. But we don't really have freezer access, unfortunately. I think that if we did, we would be stocking up in there too.
Let's talk about the pantry then. What should people be thinking about in their pantry?
Well, I believe that you must always have three kinds of rice.
Three kinds of rice, okay.
Three kinds of rice. A long, a medium, and a short. They'll do very different things for you. I like to have a really good aged basmati, a nice aromatic jasmine, and then I love like a really high quality sushi rice, like tamaki gold. That's our standard in the house. And it's just really nice. Those three kinds of rice can help you kind of cook the globe. You know, you can have tadig one day with your basmati rice and then make hand rolls the other day with sushi rice. So I think having a bunch of rice is great. I love having lots of beans. I've been really into giant white lima beans lately because they are so creamy and they taste so indulgent. It feels like something a little bit more special than like your typical cannellini or kidney bean. And then I've just been like a big fan of quinoa lately. We're on like a weird quinoa kick.
The holidays are coming up and lots of folks associate holidays with food. And unfortunately, a lot of us are not going to be spending time with our families in person because of the pandemic. How do you cook for the holidays this year? What should people be thinking about? I mean, you know, part of the joy is making huge meals that everyone can share, but we can't do that this time.
I honestly think that you should still make the huge meal.
You do?
Yeah, I think it feels really fun celebratory, even if it's just you and like your immediate family, because you can have leftovers. And I still want to feel like I'm having a celebration. For me, this year, more than ever, it's very important to have like a really fun and exciting Thanksgiving and Christmas, because the year has been terrible.
I'm not going to disagree. It has definitely, I mean, there are already Christmas ornaments that have 2020 and, you know, displayed over a roaring dumpster fire. So I'm not going to disagree with you there. But one thing I will say is that it's been, not everybody is as talented as you, Sola, in the culinary arts. And so for those folks who are listening and saying, I don't even know, I don't have one kind of rice, and Sola wants me to get three kinds of rice, what advice would you give to the folks who are not as adept at the culinary arts?
Well, I think a really easy thing that can also be very comforting is a braise. And you really can't mess up a braise. You can get a tougher cut like pork shoulder or lamb shoulder or beef short ribs. It's really easy. You can do a larger quantity or a smaller quantity, and you just kind of, you sear it, you cover it halfway with some broth or another kind of flavorful liquid, and then you just let it simmer on top of your stovetop, really delicately, partially covered, or throw it in the oven and let it go. And you just let it cook until it's totally tender, and you really can't mess it up. You can't overcook it. And it's one of those things that I feel like, especially when it's colder, it makes me feel really cozy. And the great thing about it is it gets better the next day, so you can still make a big like cut of meat, feel like you're having that festive feeling, but you're going to have it for like a week and it's only going to get better. And I think that that's like, anyone can make a braise, and I think it's a really good skill to have in your back pocket. It's so much easier than you think. You just cook it forever. That's all there is to it.
Are there, you mentioned earlier, one pot or one pan meals. Are there any that you recommend that are particularly simple to make? Are there any go-tos for folks who might be juggling, you know, other things like kids and work and now back to cooking?
I mean, I think there's a lot of things. I have a one skillet chicken and rice that I just did for Food 52. But besides that, I think you could do any kind of stew, any kind of braise that's like a one pot situation. And I think that a soup is just like a really nice thing. You could use whatever is in your fridge. Start by cooking out some aromatics, add some water or broth, and then throw in whatever you have around and just let it simmer. And it's like one bowl, really wholesome, really comforting. And it's one of those things that you can just like put on low, it'll do its thing, and then you can go take care of the kids or take care of the dogs or whatever else you have to do, and it'll kind of take care of itself.
Sola, what about all those sourdough starters? Are you sensing that we're heading back that way?
I never really got into the sourdough thing, to be
that was
honest.
Sort of a tongue-in-cheek question, but I mean, people seem pretty serious that that was like a thing that they were getting into. My sense is that people may be dissuaded from going there again.
I know a lot of people went really hard into it. I personally, like, for me, it feels like too much like another pet, and I have a hard enough time with my current pets, but I think that there are people who are still going to do it. I have a friend who bought, actually, at the beginning of this, she bought a 50-pound bag of flour, and she's still making her way through it.
So I'm wondering, that's another thing. Are there things for kids in our lives? Are there ways that kids can be entertained in the kitchen as we head into the colder months here, particularly around the holidays? Should we be thinking about cookies and other treats for the kids?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that there's always simple tasks that you can give kids in the kitchen. That was how my mom would keep me out of trouble, by having me just stand next to her in the kitchen and like clean vegetables and roll out rotis. There's a lot of stuff that kids can do that don't require any knives at all. And I think, yeah, decorating cookies is a really fun one. And it's very easy and inexpensive to make a really simple sugar cookie dough. And I think that you could entertain kids for hours having them roll out dough, cut out shapes, and then decorate it with icing. I truly believe kids should always be in the kitchen. I did it. I have all my fingers. The other kids can do it too.
On a more serious note, we have been talking about the number of Americans who are struggling to put food on the table at all right now. And I'm wondering if you and any other chefs that you know have found ways to help support others in this pandemic.
I know in the beginning, a lot of restaurants were cooking for hospitals and things like that. And it is difficult, but I think that the thing that they need the most more is money rather than donations of food, because a lot of these food banks buy in bulk. And there are specific things that they need, because a lot of times when you donate, it's stuff that you don't want, which means it's stuff that they don't want either. So I think doing little fundraisers on Instagram have been really cool, because I've been blown away. Like, I can do a half hour live and raise like a few thousand dollars, which I think can be really helpful. I know that it's tough right now for everyone. Money's tight for a lot of people. But like, yeah, I think if you can give a few bucks here and there, that's really helpful and really adds up. I think it might actually be more helpful than like taking random canned goods to your local food bank. But it's all good. Do whatever you can possibly do, honestly.
Shifting gears for a minute here, this summer we've been covering on this show, we've been talking about the lack of diversity in media on so many levels, and it is happening across the board. We know that it happened at Condé Nast magazine Bon Appetit. This summer you spoke out about that culture of racism and pay inequity there, and since then you've created your own YouTube show. How's the transition been for you from sort of a more traditional magazine outlet to being on your own on YouTube?
It's been interesting. With my new show, I actually have a lot of creative freedom and control. So that is really fun and exciting, but also a little scary, because if I put something out there and people don't like it, I got no one to blame but myself. But it's a transition I'm still getting used to. It's all happened really quickly, but I am very pleased with the positive feedback so far.
And how do you feel about the future of food media right now?
I think that a lot of people in food media have become aware of these issues, and I think that there will be a lot of changes in the right direction. You know, it's unfortunate how it had to come about, but I think we're going to get there. I really have a lot of hope.
Any remaining tips that people should be thinking about when they're preparing for this winter and their pantries?
Go for a lot of grains. Stuff that maybe you haven't tried before, you know, try, because it can be kind of boring cooking out of a pantry if all you have is pasta. So don't be afraid to try something new, like farro or couscous or quinoa. At the end of the day, you're just boiling stuff in water, so you'll be okay. You'll figure it out.
Sola Elwayli is the host of the YouTube series Stump Sola and a resident at Food 52. Sola, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's our show for today. Hope you enjoyed it. And of course, you can keep calling us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253, or tweet us at The Takeaway. And early voting is still happening in many states, so please keep hitting the polls and get those absentee ballots in. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.